For the week of March 21st, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 46, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And hanging out on Chat Roulette, I'm Michael Giltz.
Yes, I guess we'll be talking about Chat Roulette a little later on during this episode. And before we get to it, of course, we always start with box office. We'll talk a little bit about some 3D issues, both in the movies and on television. We couldn't go past one episode without talking about Conan O'Brien, so we'll throw him into the mix.
Or Avatar.
You know what? Just throw all the 3D movies into the mix. And we have a ton of big deal or big whoop stories, and we'll end with a little, well, it's kind of music news, but it's also kind of new media news. We'll let you decide. But as always, we begin our show by recounting how we did at the North American box office with Michael Giltz.
That's right. It's another weekend at the box office. March is hot, thanks to Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, which grossed $34.5 million in the U.S. That's $265 million total, which is a record for a Tim Burton film. Overseas, he also grossed another $47 million for $300 million overseas. Total worldwide is $565 million. This is Tim Burton's biggest hit of all time, U.S., overseas, worldwide, you name it. It's not, of course, Johnny Depp's biggest film yet, because he had a little movie series called Pirates of the Caribbean. At number two, in a bit of a surprise, was Diary of a Wimpy Kid at Fox with $21.8 million, which just edged out Jennifer Aniston and Gerard Butler's The Bounty Hunter, which grossed $21 million. I actually thought Wimpy Kid would beat it by more, but there you go. And number four was Jude Law on a flop, Repo Men, which didn't open. It just grossed a measly $6.1 million. And at number five, Holding Okay, was the modestly budgeted comedy She's Out of My League at $6 million. It's just about equaled its budget, and so it should do fine for everyone. And 6 through 10 is just movies that are just edging out a few more million dollars or flopping completely, like Our Family Wedding, Robert Pattinson's Remember Me, Green Zone, the Matt Damon film, which has been a disaster. It's grossing $24 million total and quickly falling. And, of course, Avatar, which is grossed another $4 million because it always grosses money.
But it lost 482 screens.
Right. Well, of course. So we'll get to that later. As we've spoken before, Alice in Wonderland bigfooted and took away all its 3D screens, basically. And then coming up, we've got How to Train Your Dragon and Clash of the Titans. There are not enough 3D screens to go around. I saw Wimpy Kid and Green Zone this weekend. I don't know about you guys. What did you see?
I was sleeping, trying to recover from Show West.
Yeah, I've got three comments about this box office. First of all, The Bounty Hunter, yikes. Jennifer Aniston, Gerard Butler, big yikes. No, I didn't see it. If somebody like me doesn't even want to see it, and that's like the genre that is, you know, my most favorite, that's bad. Second, Repo Man, what happened to Jude Law's career? And then three, I saw Remember Me. It was me and a bunch of teenage girls. And it's a terrible movie. But I wasn't bored.
Somebody told me a plot twist of the movie, and I didn't realize it was that it triggered run this event, and that just made me say, oh, God, I do not want to see this.
No, well, see, that's what's interesting is that this script was much better than the movie. The script read like a romantic thriller, and it was very popular when it was casting. And the movie just – it changed a lot of things in the script so that the twist at the end was more like, oh, no way. But like in a bad way, like, oh, God, no, did this have to happen?
Yeah.
Whereas in the script, it was more like it was just more, I don't know, gut wrenching, but in a good way, because it had been set up that way throughout the script, whereas it came out of nowhere in the movie.
Well, and Green Zone I found to be pretty preachy and political. But do either of you have kids or no kids? Did you read Diary of a Wimpy Kid? Do you know this book series? It's a wildly popular series of graphic novels about life in middle school, basically. And I knew it was huge among young people. And I frankly thought it would beat The Bounty Hunter by even more. But it opened pretty well. And it's an okay movie. It's harmless. It's not good. But it captures the spirit of the books and is, you know, pain-free.
I didn't know that it was a book series, but I've got to tell you, the poster made me want to actually read the book more than see the movie.
Oh, give it to your girls, Sperling. These books are so funny.
They are. They're fun, and the movie makes a little bit use of the graphic imagery of the books, and certainly in the title sequence, and once or twice during the movie. I kind of wish they'd done it more, because it's really fun visually to have those line drawings and people in front of them in a movie. It's just sort of fun, and it looks fresh and different. And it sort of wakes you up out of the ordinariness of the movie. And they should have gone even a little further with that. But, you know, it's not great, but it's okay. It's fine to take the kids. You won't be embarrassed.
Well, overall, the weekend box office was up 20% over the same frame, as they say in the biz, the same weekend last year.
Well, since last year was the highest grossing box office of all time, I would say so, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually quite decent. And then, of course, Noah Baumbach's latest film, Greenberg, opened this weekend, starring Ben Stiller. It opened on three screens and made an enormous amount of money, $120,000, but only on three screens. That's actually huge numbers for three screens.
Well, $40,000 isn't insane. I mean, it's hardly unusual to see a film with a big stars open at $40,000 or $50,000. I mean, that's
per
good.
Screen?
Yeah. I mean, we see that all the time in limited releases for new movies. That's not an insane number. I remember Platoon opening 20, 30 years ago with $100,000 on one screen. I mean, you know, I mean, $40,000 is a very strong, good opening for a movie, but in limited release, but it's not like remarkable.
I just want to insert a shout out for Brie Larson, who is in this movie and is a client of my sister's and a really great actress.
Oh, good for her. Have you seen the film?
No, but I'm planning on it.
I won't see it because it's the story of my life and I should have written the script myself. I'm just annoyed.
Did I tell you I saw your sister walking down the street in Beverly Hills?
Yeah, you don't even know my sister.
Not your sister, Michael. I meant Karen's sister.
Yeah, and if you know me, you will recognize my sister because we're twins.
Literally, identical twins.
Oh, hilarious. You know, Jon Stewart had a funny thing. He was talking about a guest came on the show, and he had a movie coming out, and Jon Stewart said, "But is it in 3D? It's got to be in 3D. I won't see it if it's not in 3D." And he was saying it very sarcastically, so I enjoyed that.
Well, this year, of course, almost every weekend you'll have a movie opening in 3D. There are 33 films slated for release. Of course, that will change over the course of the year, both upwards and downwards. And I believe it's this weekend How to Train Your Dragon opens up in theaters. This is the DreamWorks animation film that Jeffrey Katzenberg has been touting for the last year or so. And, you know, I guess that's kind of our first story here in our movies segment, which is, as you said, Michael, in our show notes, a 3D-a-palooza. But I kind of have mixed feelings about this because, frankly, I could have reported this on Celluloid Junkie about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And because I also work in the industry that I'm reporting on, I decided not to because I knew that if I did, Paramount Pictures would just nail me to a cross. And so the LA Times ran the story about how Jeffrey Katzenberg, Paramount Pictures is telling theaters that if they don't show the upcoming DreamWorks produced How to Train Your Dragon in 3D, then they won't get a 2D version. So if they were planning on playing it on two screens, and one of those screens is not 3D, and they have a 3D capable screen, they won't get the 2D version. So they have to have 3D for this to
but
work.
What about theaters that don't have a 3D screen?
Well, then that's not an issue.
It's not an issue. If they don't have a 3D screen, then they just get the 2D print. But if they have a 3D screen and they're not playing the film on 3D, then they won't get any additional 2D prints.
And does that include week two? Because, of course, the week after it opens is when Clash of the Titans comes out, and that's really what's annoying and bothering Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Right. I don't know whether it includes week two. I do know that I've spoken with several film buyers at numerous circuits throughout the U.S., and they're all complaining about the way Paramount was handling that film and saying that they haven't cut a deal for that film yet because or agreed to play it because of the way they're being forced to play it in 3D if they have a 3D screen. And, of course, Alice in Wonderland is doing incredibly well, and Disney is urging all of the theaters playing Alice in Wonderland in 3D to hold the film. The problem is that usually in each theater, there's only one screen that has 3D. So there's no place to put How to Train Your Dragon.
And basically what we're saying is there's only about 3,000 screens that can handle 3D in the country, and that's enough for about one big movie. So with three movies in the theaters at the same time, there's nowhere to give.
That's right. And of course, you know, the LA Times ran this story, and it was a very good story. So, you know, good for them. And it was interesting to read. And they pointed out something else that happened at Show West last week, which is that Jeffrey Katzenberg showed up, but not officially. He took a whole bunch of people, a very select group of people, and showed them Shrek 4, but outside the show. And there was some talk about whether, you know, he wasn't allowed to show the film, you know, at the show, or whether he was upset that Toy Story 3 screened there when he was told it wouldn't. And so as revenge, he comes and, you know, shows it privately. Then, of course, there's some talk that, well, he couldn't show it here at Show West because that would have been a public screening, and then he couldn't have premiered the film at the Tribeca Film Festival, I guess, in late April or early May.
Good heavens. Does anybody care about the Tribeca Film Festival as far as a giant animated film like that? I mean, that just seems a bizarre platform for it. I mean, Shrek itself all went up at Cannes, one of the biggest platforms in the world, but, like, Tribeca?
I don't know.
That's crazy. So I didn't know Toy Story 3 screened there. Did you see it? How was it? What did people say?
I did see it. I saw first the opening short, which, you know, John Lasseter came out and introduced, and it was really creative and very, it was a lot of fun. It was called Day and Night or Day or Night or
Day for Night?
No, it wasn't Day for Night.
Reference?
I think it was Day and Night, but it did have kind of that like 50s, 60s feel, and it was in 3D, and it was really, really good. Mm-hmm. And short. And then they screened Toy Story, and this was an interesting reaction. John Lasseter said that, you know, unfortunately the film isn't finished, of course, so they weren't going to be screening the film in 3D, and you could actually feel the audience of probably 1,000 people kind of,
well, sure,
they're disappointed. And
well, because it's a 3D film.
Right, and I guess you kind of feel that, like, 2D ghetto beginning to form, and...
No. That's only a ghetto because it was made to be seen in 3D. Nobody cares about seeing, you know, Shutter Island in 3D. It's not a 3D film. If it's shot in black and white, they want to see it in black and white. If it's shot in color, they want color. This is not a thing about, like, I only want to see movies in 3D. That's not true. It was made to be seen in 3D. That's how it was designed to be seen. So you're not seeing the movie. And, of course, they're distributors. So they're devoting their biggest, most expensive screen to this movie. And they want to see what it looks like in that process, the way their fans are
going to
see it.
Right. And they're going to they're going to see it in 3D when it is shown at trade screenings. The film isn't finished. But I have to say, even in 2D, unfinished, this is a fun movie. It's a lot. It's really good. It had people crying at the end.
How does it compare to 1 and 2? Does it hold up, like, just as well? Do you feel like it's a capper to the trilogy, or, you know? Because Toy Story 2 is considered one of the great sequels.
Oh, yes. It definitely is a very good sequel.
Oh, I'm totally excited.
It holds up. Now, don't go in expecting, you know, the greatest film since Gone with the Wind, but you'll enjoy it.
I'm expecting the greatest film.
Kevin, on the other hand, doesn't like cartoons.
Right, exactly.
Well, you'll have to go see this one, at least. Did you see 1 and 2 yet?
I saw 1.
I was with you when you saw 1.
Oh, did we see 1 together?
Yes.
I think it's, you know, I get it. I get it. I just don't like cartoons. I can't get as involved in a movie if it's a cartoon.
Would it change your mind if we called it an animated film?
You mean a cartoon?
Well, I put up the next item, which was a USA Today interview with James Cameron, the director of Avatar, of course. And I was thrilled because he agreed with me. I thought he was sort of agreeing with me. He was sort of dissing Clash of the Titans in 3D. And he was saying, first of all, they didn't take enough time to convert the movie into 3D. He says it should take like 6 months to a year to convert a 2D movie into 3D properly. And he says they spent maybe about 8 weeks doing it. And he also says you can't just throw stuff out there and expect people to, you know, take a 2D movie, slap a 3D label on it, put it out there and not wow people. If you don't take time to do it right, people are going to go and see bad movies or movies that don't wow them and go, why am I paying extra money for this? You know, so that's a big thing he argued. And I'm thrilled to hear it because I think Clash of the Titans is a disaster as far as, you know, promoting 3D and making it mainstream or even more mainstream, I guess.
I think Clash of the Titans might be a disaster, period. I mean, it almost feels like they're dumping it.
Well, I can tell you that it's funny that you should say that, Karen, because, you know, as everybody knows now, I think we reported on it last week, Jeffrey Katzenberg was very upset that Warner Brothers decided to go ahead and release this film in 3D and went so far as to send an angry email to Warner Brother chief Alan Meyer. But from more and more, what I've been hearing is, look, the 3D is bad, but let's face it, this thing was a turkey to begin with.
Mm.
This thing was never going to fly.
Well, I mean, the original movie is bad too, but it was a commercial hit, so...
The original movie's awesome. What are you talking about?
Oh, it's not good at all.
It's awesome.
Well, I actually saw a couple clips of it at Show West. Warner Brothers came and they had a big presentation about some of the films they're releasing later in the year. And they brought out Louis Leterrier. Hold on. I'm probably, yeah, it's Louis Leterrier. You know what? He's a French director. His first name is Louis. And I apologize to our French listening audience. You really don't want to hear me butcher Mr. Louis filmmaker guy's name.
Because, Frenchy guy.
French guy, yeah. Because, you know, he is a talented filmmaker, and you can tell in 2D, it's visually stunning. In 3D, it looks like a word that I probably couldn't or shouldn't say on this podcast.
You think they've made it look worse by trying to shove it into 3D?
Yes, and you know, while on stage with Sam Worthington, he said, oh, I can't wait to see it because it's the first time I'm seeing it in 3D. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I'm sure you had nothing to do with it being turned into 3D. Now, there have been reports that he was against the conversion to 3D, but I'm pretty sure he was a part of it at the end of the day. And, you know, the problem is the film was designed and shot in 2D, which means there's a lot of camera moves. There's a lot of production that was done that you wouldn't normally do if the film was going to be released in 3D. So all those camera moves, all of those wider shots, the things that Cameron avoided in Avatar, are in this film.
Yeah, and he points that out in this article, which I thought was, it's a really good article, because he talks also not just about movies, but he made some interesting points too about 3D televisions and what the future of those might be, and pointing out that whereas film has got an overload of content and not enough screens, it's the opposite for TV, which is that they're going to have plenty of screens, but not enough content.
Right.
Right. And I don't think anybody addresses yet the idea of it being sort of an insular experience, 3D glasses, rather than a group thing, which TV is. But there is a lot of TV product coming out. But before you go that, we should mention that they did also talk about Avatar coming out on DVD, but it'll be out on 2D. It comes out on Earth Day, April 22nd. Our friend Jeff Boucher of the LA Times was apparently the first one to print that information. It's going to be a big, you know, it's going to be a beautiful looking DVD, but there will be a far more lavish version coming out probably in time for Christmas. So normally I don't like it when they release multiple versions of DVDs. You should sort of have your choices all at once. But as long as they announce it, as long as people know in advance that that's what's happening, at least they have the choice to wait and just rent the first DVD and buy the deluxe box set later on.
Yeah, but how many people really know that? We do, our friends do, you know, insiders do, but you know, my mom doesn't read stuff like that.
With Avatar, I think a lot of people probably will. But what I really find interesting is none of these versions will have 3D on it.
No. They may very well do that by the end of the year. No, it's the first version that definitely will be in 2D. They're talking about a 3D version after the re-release in theaters. And then the deluxe version in the fall might offer 3D. That's my understanding. And Karen, you're right, but at least they've announced it. Sometimes it's when they don't at least announce it that there's going to be a more elaborate version later that I get annoyed. At least they've told people, at least they made the effort to inform the public. So in that case, at least they've given people a chance to find out. And any responsible reviewer like myself should tell people, yeah, this is out now, but they're putting the movie back out and another version will be available in the fall.
Yeah, they are going to milk this movie for all it's worth.
Of course. Well, and as you and James Cameron mentioned, there isn't a ton of 3D product for television yet, but there were a couple things that I hadn't been aware of that I saw announcements of. There's a fair amount of sports programming coming out that'll be shown a little bit in 3D in the next few months. The Masters Tournament, which is, of course, the tournament that Tiger Woods returns to golf, some of that will be shown in 3D, about 10 hours of it.
Yeah, basketball. We should say it's the PGA Masters because I think there's also a bowling Masters and a...
Well, I said Tiger Woods, I'm pretty sure, in golf, his return to golf.
Well, it could be, you know, something lascivious.
Tiger Woods' return to bowling.
Anyway.
Yes, there's the bowling is the PBA, Professional Bowling Tour. And there's lots of things that are called Masters, but you're right. College basketball's Final Four, some of that will be in 3D. Baseball is doing a lot of experiments. A Yankee game may be shown in 3D. The home run derby as part of the All-Star game and a part of the All-Star game itself may be shown in 3D. But I thought, oh, wow, they're going to be handing out 3D glasses and encouraging them. No. This is not for like the regular broadcast. It's not the whole thing. It's all these things are sort of experiments. They're going to be showing them on, you know, digital tier channels or direct TV transmissions. So it's really clearly quite a bit of an experiment. It only works on TVs that are 3D compatible. Mine I bought like a year ago. I don't even think it is. You know, I bought it like a year ago, plasma, a ton of money. But I don't think it's 3D compatible. So most people won't get a chance to watch it right away, but they are experimenting. They are trying it out and they're trying to see what it looks like and get people excited.
Well, yeah, and you know, that was the story that the LA Times was pointing out in theaters, was that there's just not enough screens. And, you know, after Show West, I can tell you, exhibitors, movie theater owners are definitely ramping up as quickly as possible to increase the number of screens, and it should hit something around, you know, maybe 5,000 by the end of the year.
So, but the best case scenario at the end of the year is one movie can be on 3,000 to 4,000 screens and another one on 1,000 to 2,000.
Right. That is right.
So that's still not enough for even just three movies in theaters at once. They really, so what's the timetable look like now for the end of 2011 maybe?
Well, we'll probably go up to between 7,000 and 10,000 screens by the end of 2011.
Okay.
Which then you start getting into the ability to release 2 to 3 films simultaneously in 3D. But what I think is interesting, whether it's films, which we talked about Clash of the Titans and what I considered to be poor 3D, and several other people that saw the same footage I saw thought it was just fine. But then again, I'm kind of a 3D aficionado, and so I'm somewhat a little bit more, I've got a more of a particular eye, kind of like an audiophile might not like the sound on a CD, whereas I might find it okay.
Can I end this 3D conversation with a total non sequitur?
Please.
I was reminded of it by LA Times and Jeff Boucher. I was reading an article in the Sunday LA Times written by Jeff Boucher, and I'm not placing any blame on him. I'm placing a blame on a copy editor that the LA Times clearly doesn't have. It was an article about the original X-Men, and they had interviewed Bryan Singer, who was the director, and Lauren Shuler Donner, who was the producer. And half the time that it mentioned Lauren Shuler Donner's name, it called her Donner Shuler.
Oh, whoops.
Yeah, major whoops. Are newspapers not hiring copy editors anymore? Because, you know, I'll do it.
Well, was it part of his blog or was it part of a regular news item?
It was in the actual physical paper, if you can believe that. So it might have been in his blog, but it was in the actual paper.
Oh, well, then that was definitely copy edited, and therefore that's a mistake.
Yeah, no, it's not him. It's definitely a copy editor problem.
Well, copy editor, fact checker, and they don't have fact checkers. Every reporter is ultimately responsible for the facts in their own story. A copy editor might have caught that mistake, but the reporter should be the one who knows whether what their name is and how to spell it.
No, but it was Lauren. I mean, half the time it was right and half the time it was wrong. So it was just
bizarre. Yeah.
It's a lazy mistake.
I wonder, that's a good question, whether newspapers are cutting back on their copy editors.
Well, remember, Karen, that a lot of the stuff that appears in the LA Times, and I do get it every day at the end of my driveway, and I'm not stealing somebody else's, it is the paper that I pay for. I say that because somebody stole my paper on Saturday. A lot of the stuff that appears in the LA Times appears first in their blogs the day before, or sometimes 2 days before. And so, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if that piece did appear online first. And what's interesting to me is the conundrum I ran into, which is not to, you know, it's not all about me, but I think it's something that a lot of people are facing. More and more people who are actually working in an industry, whether it's the entertainment industry or the, I don't know, energy industry or the healthcare industry, the people that are working in that industry have their own blogs, which are somewhat authoritative and therefore are turned to as reliable news sources. However, if they write about the industry, if they write the truth about the industry and what they really know, and not things that are under NDA, I'm talking about things that are occurring, they can get into a lot of trouble. And that's exactly what would have happened if I had written something first about this whole issue that Paramount is doing with How to Train Your Dragon. And of course, that story was also about the fact that there aren't enough 3D screens. But, you know, I think this is going to become a running problem, not just for me, but for many media outlets that are kind of blurring the lines between journalism and industry.
Yeah, but Lauren Shuler Donner's name is Lauren Shuler Donner.
Anyway,
let's move on.
That's why you need independent journalists and not just people who work in the industry blogging about it. You know, you need independent outside people who can actually cover the industry and not worry about like, I'll get in trouble or they'll be angry at me. You know, they have to be independent. So you can't cover the industry as well, you know, necessarily in the same way that an independent journalist from a media outlet can, who's paid full time to pay attention and write stuff that is going to make people upset. But if it's true, it's true.
Right. And, you know, just to finish off the 3D thing, you know, we were talking about, you know, the bad Clash of the Titans conversion. But, did you know, in that article that James Cameron was quoted in, He said, you know, how hard is it to shoot 3D was the question. Is it much different from shooting 2D? It is much different. And he went on to say, Mario Fiordi won the Academy Award for Cinematography for Avatar shooting in HD and stereo. He had never shot in stereo before. He had a week of testing. He figured it out. And he shot a movie and won an Academy Award. So while there is a learning curve, it's not a steep or prohibitive learning curve. Let me get this straight. Okay, so that's his quote. You're telling me you gambled $350 million after only a week of tests? Something tells me that's not exactly
true. No. He's not saying he made the movie after years of tests, but as far as the cinematographer was concerned, that he sort of was practicing and training to shoot it in 3D. He wasn't saying that they spent a week and then decided to make the film in 3D. Not at all.
No, what I'm saying is you think some cinematographer stepped onto a set and after only a week of testing with these brand new cameras, which, by the way, are patented, decided to like, yeah, I could do this.
Well, but nobody else, you couldn't have any prior experience to them because it was brand new technology. So, I mean, it was all learn as you go and experiment, you know, while you're shooting. That's why it took so many years, surely.
Right. And, you know, he goes on to talk about the patents that he has on some of this equipment. And here's what I find interesting, and I'm going to read his quote. Depending on who our strategic alliances are with, we'll either put out our intellectual property and make it available for licensing or put it into a pool or whatever it is. Or we'll be in the suing people business for a long time. We figured this stuff out empirically 6 or 7 years ago, and we patented it. If people try to do it the way we've done it on Avatar, they'll get a phone call. Now, what I find interesting about all of this is that digital cinema, when the studios decided to go for digital cinema, they started stripping out all of the intellectual property. So Dolby surround sound, for instance, gone. DTS surround sound, gone. Anything that someone could charge a license for was gone. It had to be open source. And I sit on some of those SMPTE panels and sit there and help work out those standards. And it's very interesting now that instead of sound being the proprietary technology, it's becoming 3D. So you have RealD 3D, Dolby 3D, Master Image 3D. I wrote about Panavision 3D last week. And now you have, you know, the ability to capture 3D as a proprietary process. It's kind of interesting to me.
Can we keep the 3D convo short? I thought we were going to keep it short.
Okay. Well, yeah, apparently it's only interesting to me.
3D is the new cartoon, apparently, to Karen. Well, let's talk about Conan O'Brien.
Which, by the way, are you guys following him on Twitter?
He's hilarious.
He's hysterical. And he's following one girl.
Yeah.
We talked about this.
And it's like changed your whole life. Oh, have we talked about this? Oh.
Yeah.
What I love about Karen is she totally forgets the previous episode.
And I listen to them, too.
She's like Memento. She lives in the moment.
I do. I live in the moment. I think it's brilliant that Conan went on tour. And I think the name of his tour is hysterical, which is something like, yeah, it's illegal for me to be funny in prime time.
Contractually prohibited from being funny on television tour.
Yeah, it's hysterical.
Actually, but it's a comedy music review, which is called The Legally Prohibited from Being Funny on Television Tour.
Yeah, that's what Michael said. But it's such a modern way of staying relevant until he can be back on TV. It's great.
Well, there's talk that they're going to film it and make a concert film out of it, which he can do, apparently. Doesn't violate the terms. And, of course, he started the whole thing just to give his staff something to do while they were looking for a new job. And I'm not sure who linked to it, but there's another item here about possible syndication scenario. Obviously, he's trying to make a deal with Fox. Fox is trying to work out the money. NBC spent about $90 million a year to produce The Tonight Show with Conan. Fox wants to spend two-thirds of that. They want to cut the budget by a third down to $60 million. Can he scrape by on $60 million a year? That's the total budget of creating the show, of course. And
well, I think that excludes his salary, by the way.
I would imagine, yeah. It does. Otherwise, it wouldn't be it. But, yeah, can he scrape by making the show that amount? That's why. But – you know, Fox is trying to figure it out. They know some of their stations won't be forced to do it, I guess, is the idea. They don't have to show the...
Yeah, they don't have to do it.
Well, no, they don't have to show it at 11 p.m. all in tandem, right. But they'll show it at midnight, or they'll show it at 11:30, or even, believe it or not, 12:30, which is when Conan O'Brien was on in the first place.
And that would be a disaster for him as far as ratings and audience size, because you obviously every half hour into late night, you lose more and more viewers. And but the possibility is that if that doesn't work, some major syndicators, including CBS, have talked to him about doing a syndicated version and not necessarily late night, but like the 7 to 8 p.m. hours. They'd be competing with Entertainment Tonight and, you know, Wheel of Fortune and all those sort of shows that lead into prime time in a lot of stations around the country.
Yeah, well, just ask Oprah Winfrey how lucrative syndication can be.
Well, here's what's interesting to me, is if he decided to go out on the road to keep his crew employed, are they all traveling with him? Because that sort of sucks.
It sucks, but it beats unemployment.
It's better than sitting at home, but I don't know. Why does it suck going on four cities? These writers and people don't get to go on tour a lot. I think it's fun.
Yeah, but these people uprooted their families, and they keep talking about how these people uprooted their families and took their kids out of school. Okay, so now these people get to be away from their families. Excellent.
I don't think they're going to – I think it's the roadies and the crew and those people who are used to doing whatever that will tour. Obviously, the writers and the people who help create the show won't be there. You know, not going to be backstage writing material. Whoever wanted to go on tour could, and whoever didn't want to didn't have to, obviously.
I'm just pointing out that it's a little bit different than just, you know, showing up at work, you know, on the NBC lot.
Well, as we predicted, this whole thing, this whole new Conan O'Brien show, and I don't mean the stage show, I mean the television show, if it does appear on Fox, if they do cut a deal, and everybody is assuming, including some of the Fox executives who have been quoted anonymously, that it's just a matter of time. This is going to happen. But if it does work out, it's all going to come down to money, as we said last week.
Yeah, and I would be very wary about doing a show from 7 to 8 p.m. You know, Jay Leno has sort of a 7 p.m. vibe. I don't think Conan does at all.
No.
I think he was just starting to settle into late night. I don't think that would necessarily work well at all.
No, not at all. And actually, that's part of what some of these stories about it say. And we have to credit Joe Adalian from The Wrap for providing the story on the syndication scenarios.
Well, let's move on to music. I post a little item, just an update for, you know, American Idol listeners, the four people that still watch. It's the number one show in the country. And I've been tracking the singles of Chris Allen and Adam Lambert to see if either one of them would break into the top 10. These are their first singles from their albums. You know, there was a single after the show finale. But now Chris Allen's first single, Live While You're Dying, Live Like You're Dying, seems to have peaked at number 18. And Adam Lambert's one, seems to have peaked at number 22. So neither one broke into the top 10 with their first single. On the other hand, Adam Lambert's album is at number 71, which is, it's already obviously way out of the top 10 and, you know, not doing well. While Chris Allen's is at number 172.
You know what's really funny about this is that you have an explanation point after 172. I first read that as Allen's is at 1,721. I was like, oh, my God.
It might as well be. 172 is, you know, you're in amongst, like, Bob Seger's greatest hits and stuff that's been out for decades. That's a very, very low ranking. Clearly, it's, you know, their sell-by date is done. A new single could reignite album sales, obviously, but they're clearly not burning up the charts. Danny Gokey, by the way, is in the, debuted at number 4 and is in the top 20 for the moment with his debut album, thanks to a slot on American Idol. So neither guy as of yet has burned up the charts with their debut solo albums, but they'll be around for a while. They'll have a second album to try and get it right, and we'll see what happens to them.
You know what I credit this to, actually? I credit this to piracy. And I'm not trying to get on my piracy bandwagon, but the other day I was doing some research, logged onto some BitTorrent site, I can't even remember which one, and the latest Gorillaz album had 7,000 cedars. 7,000.
What does that mean, cedars?
That means that there were over 7,000 people with that file on their computer for people to download.
Wow.
So it's just remarkable. And most people, what they do is they grab the file from these 7,000 cedars, and then they don't seed themselves. So it's over 7,000 cedars at that very moment in time. But it's a rolling moment. And it's just remarkable how piracy really has made a huge, huge impact in the music industry. I know I'm not saying anything that hasn't been said 1,000 times before over the last 10 years, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on in the episode, but still.
That's why I was surprised by the Michael Jackson deal. Sony signed a deal with Michael Jackson's estate, and they signed a deal worth over $200 million, the biggest single deal apparently in music history for just music, and it covers upcoming albums of live concerts and unreleased material and all that sort of stuff, reissues of albums like Bad and Off the Wall. They want to stay in the Michael Jackson business. And yes, since he died, he's sold 31 million albums, which in this day and age is like selling 200 million. I mean, it's just a huge amount of music. But to me, it's like, you know, that boat sailed. I mean, sales are not going to, like, people are not going to be rushing to the stores to buy live albums and, you know, a reissue of Bad with an extra track or two. I just, Michael Jackson was not a prolific artist who created a ton of great material, like, say, Bob Dylan or Prince or somebody that, you know, for years you're going to hear great music coming out of the vaults. He took a long time. And basically what he put on the album was all that was worth putting on it. I mean, the This Is It soundtrack had a single, and that was a flop. And I'm surprised. I just don't think – I mean, they don't want to be out of the Michael Jackson business, but that seems like a ton of money for in this day and age when albums just don't sell anymore.
I don't know. I think Michael Jackson has some weird mystique around him. When I was pulling into the Las Vegas airport in my taxi, there was a car in front of us that had – an MJ little sticker on it, like the way some people have those stickers on their rear window with their family.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, the Calvin and Hobbes little
right.
line drawings. It was an MJ line drawing in white with, you know, 1955 to 2009 or whatever the dates of his birth and death were. And I thought, wow, okay, I guess.
Shamong. Right,
I think he's still alive.
That would be awesome.
He's hanging out with Elvis.
Well, tell us about Chat Roulette, Sperling.
Okay, yeah. So this is my non sequitur for the episode. There is a website called Chat Roulette, which it was created by some 19-year-old Russian teenager. Which I guess because you're 19, you are a teenager. So, I guess I didn't have to say 19 and teenager in the same sentence, is what I'm saying. However, basically what it is you go onto this website, your microphone and your webcam turns on, and then you are given randomly a person somewhere in the world who is also on the site to speak with. And then if you don't like them, you can just, you know, hit next and you get to the next person. And so 90% of the people on this are men, and the other 10%, well, I should say 80% are men. 10%.
Yeah, you want to see what you want to say about most of those 80% of men are
naked.
Doing when you land on them?
Well, I was going to say 10% are male genitalia. And then there's like 10% of like girls, usually in dorm rooms, just giggling and like in groups, just kind of staring at the camera, not saying anything. And usually they kind of, you know, hit next pretty quickly. I've never actually been on the site myself. However, there is a guy, and I'm hope I'm pronouncing his name right. His name is Merton or Merton. I don't know how to pronounce his name. He is
Merton.
Just call him French filmmaker guy.
Yeah. I believe he's from the U.S. He is a self-taught piano player, and he did this funny improv bit while on Chat Roulette. So he was sitting at his piano, and he would sit there, and you know, people would kind of land on him, and he would then sing about them. And so here's just a little sample.
Reclining dude in a white tank top, leaning his head on his hand. Semi-Italian looking, just like his parents had planned.
And now the guy is
probably
laughing.
Probably hanging in New York City. From the looks of the walls, I only hope that he does not choose to show me his hanging on Chat Roulette. Oh, come on.
It was a girl, and she immediately nexted him. So then he gets to, like, let me skip forward here.
It's not really funny if you don't see the visuals.
Yeah, he gets to these.
She raised her eyebrows in surprise. Her friend had shades on, so you couldn't see her eyes.
And then
3333333333333 This girl is serious about the number 3. Whatever you say to her, she's gonna make hearts with her hand.
Okay, so that was like basically, you know, he was just singing about what they were doing on screen. There's three girls, and they type the number 3 about 1,000 times. And so he's who knows who this guy is, but he's got over 4 million views on YouTube. And it was posted, I don't know when it was posted. It was posted last week sometime. Within a couple of days, Ben Folds, the musician in North Carolina, shows up at a concert and decides to do an ode to Merton or whatever his name is, And he goes on chat roulette in front of 2,000 people, which is a very risky proposition since, again, 10% of the people that you wind up seeing are male genitalia. So here he is at his concert.
Are you sad? We've come to cheer you up. Don't be sad.
There's some sad-looking guy.
Don't be sad. 2,000 people here in Charlotte are here to cheer you up. Hello, Mr. Shirtless Man. How are you doing today? Is it hot in there?
He's going through all of these different people.
I thought the original guy was a lot funnier.
Well, yeah.
There's a note on a white piece of paper.
There's a note on the screen.
What does it say?
And he can't read it.
Is there really a person in there? Show your face if there is. Show your face if there is.
So the guy lowers the piece of paper and shows his face.
Sideways. I gotta play minor chords. Gonna read sideways. If you turn your head, I win.
So that's like a big
win.
So that's like a big thing on chat roulette is people will put this note up instead of their face, and the latest trend is they'll put up a note that's sideways that says, if you turn your head, I win. And of course most people turn their head, and then once they turn their head, the person then, you know, puts a little check mark like, oh, you know, I won another one. And so it's kind of funny how this meme, if you will, has spread throughout the internet in less than a week to the point where it's being played in front of 2,000 people. And while you're right, Karen, I believe the first guy was funnier. Ben Folds has a much better voice.
Well, the thing is, the first guy sort of looks like Ben Folds and sounds like him. And people online comment and said, are you Ben Folds? He's like, no, I'm not Ben Folds. And so that was, I think it was part of the reason why he picked up on it and did it. So I'm sure we'll link to the videos online. And of course, as we would say, it's gone viral. But which brings me to a point I have, which I got an email saying, this artist has created a viral video. It hadn't even been released yet. I'm like, we've created a viral video. It's like, no, that's not how it works.
You've created a video.
Right. You can't call it a viral video. It's like people always put the cart before the horse. It's just ridiculous.
When did meme become a douchebaggier way of saying fad?
Oh my God.
I'm turning my head sideways while I laugh.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, before I actually fall off my chair laughing, we should probably move right into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we decide whether the top entertainment news stories of the week were a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story is about Chris Evans, who has been picked to play Captain America in the film version. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
This is a huge deal. It's a huge deal for his career, and it's a huge deal for the movie because he's not only going to be playing Captain America in Captain America, he's going to be playing Captain America in the film version of The Avengers, which they're starting to shoot in 2011. He's a terrible choice for the role, but this is a very big deal.
Michael.
It's a big deal for Chris and for his brother Scott. His Scott just lost his big plot line on the daytime soap One Life to Live. He plays a cop who had a gay lover, and they just ended that whole storyline. He's still on the show, technically, but that was a bummer, bad news for him. So good news for his brother this week. So the Evans family is doing okay. Plus, it's not Channing Tatum, and all the fans online are thrilled.
Yeah, that's true. But the creators of Captain America wanted John Hamm to play Captain America, who would have been a good choice.
That would have been a good choice.
Yeah.
Moving on to Viacom and YouTube, who of course are suing each other. Well, actually, Viacom is suing YouTube for $1 billion because apparently they've seen Austin Powers. It's all about how YouTube was putting, you know, clips of The Daily Show and other copyrighted material on their website, and Viacom got ticked off and sued Google over it. And now all of these internal emails and internal documents are coming out, and it turns out that MTV wanted to try and buy YouTube and couldn't convince the Viacom staffers or management to move fast enough. And it turns out that YouTube was actually trying to take down copyrighted material. They just, you know, there was just so much of it being uploaded that they...
And it turns out that Viacom was on the sly uploading their own stuff onto YouTube, knowing that it's such a powerful platform.
Right. So the marketing people were uploading it and the legal people were saying, hey, take it down. Which, by the way, welcome to big, giant media conglomerates.
But what's so awesome about this, and I think this is a gigantic deal, such a big deal that I thought it almost should have been our Inside Baseball segment, is that all of these emails that are coming out are just so delicious. It's like, you know, Larry Page saying like these really incriminating things like, well, you know, if we take down copyrighted material, we're going to be losing, you know, 80% of our audience. So let's just keep it up. You know, like just horrible, horrible, incriminating things.
I think it's a big deal because I can remember back in 92 when the lawyers at Premier Magazine were saying, please don't discuss articles and emails. You'll have to explain what you said and your flippant half thought out comments. And they were just petrified by emails, petrified by that paper trail.
Well, right. And I remember actually when Regal went public, their head film buyer at the time, when the SEC lawyers came in to his office, he doesn't like computers, so he doesn't really even use email. And they asked him, do you have any, you know, anything on your computer? Because we're going to have to go through that. And he said, no, I don't use email. And they were like, oh, thank goodness. Because
it's dangerous. It really is.
Yes.
But what's interesting is that Larry Page had deleted all of his, but it was the guy that he had emailed to who no longer worked at Google who had kept them all.
Right.
It just gets better and better.
Our next story is kind of an unfortunate one. The week after winning an Oscar for Best Actress for her role in The Blind Side, Sandra Bullock has moved out of her Orange County, California home, which she shared with Jesse James, after it was revealed in a magazine, In Touch Weekly, that he was having an affair for the last 11 months with a tattoo model named Michelle Bombshell McGee. And I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of her, but
she's one classy lady.
Oh my God. I mean, she's got tattoos literally everywhere.
Here's what I think is really most interesting about this story. And of course, I'm just devastated and feel like Jesse James has personally let me down. But what I find really interesting about this story is that it broke right after the Oscars. And somebody had to have been paying this woman off, because if this had broke during the Oscar campaign, I mean, it really would have had an interesting effect, I think.
It would have helped her, if anything.
Yeah, it would have helped her. The same outcome would have happened.
I don't know.
She's just even more sympathetic.
Yeah, but still, I just think that the timing is really interesting.
But why? You're right about that. I thought about that too, because if In Touch had it, you think if this woman was going to sell her story, why didn't she do it during the Oscar campaign? You're right about that.
And it's probably because she knew, like most people knew, that Sandra Bullock would win the Oscar and it would be worth even more afterwards. So she probably gambled a little bit with it.
Well, People Magazine is reporting that she got paid $30,000 for the story. And Jesse James released a statement. He says, the vast majority of the allegations reported are untrue and unfounded. Beyond that, I will not dignify these private matters with any further public comment. There is only one person to blame for this whole situation, and that is me. It's because of my poor judgment that I deserve everything bad that is coming my way. This has caused my wife and kids pain and embarrassment beyond comprehension, and I am extremely saddened to have brought this on them.
I wish you hadn't read that. I don't want to talk about it. I find it interesting to talk about the timing of it. That sort of makes sense to me. Otherwise, why are we talking about gossip?
So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
For Sandra Bullock?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big deal for her and her husband and family, but it's ultimately a big whoop for everybody else.
Michael?
Yeah, it's private life. I don't care about it.
What I found way more interesting was that the story that a couple of
The curse is awesome.
Yeah, the Daily Beast ran it and the LA Times ran it, that over the past 12 years, 8 of the Best Actress winners had busted up with their lovers after winning. Kate Winslet won for 2008, and she, I guess, announced within the year that she was divorcing Sam Mendes, Reese Witherspoon, Hilary Swank, Charlize Theron, Halle Berry, Julie Roberts, Gwyneth Paltrow, Helen Hunt. Five of the splits occurred less than a year after the Oscar triumphs. Although I have to say, Karen, I don't think Sean Penn won Best Actress.
Yeah, but they should have detailed Best Actor. Did all the men stay married?
I don't know.
I hope they went and checked, because otherwise it's sexist.
The only reason why I had Sean Penn on my mind is because there was an article about this before the Sandra Bullock Jesse James story broke, and it was just I was reading my Us Weeklies a little bit behind. And, you know, reading it, knowing what I know now, I was like, oh, my God. Oh, because, you know, they detailed the curse before it happened on such a major scale.
You're behind on your Us Weeklies.
Yeah, behind on my Us Weeklies.
Well, it's true that, you know, winning the award can, you know, getting that new level of fame can really put stress on your career and life. You know, it seems like it should be this, you know, big happy time, but it can really pressure you to, like, now's your chance. Now you got to strike. Now you got to make the right move, make the right deals, make the right movies to capitalize on it. And it's so hard to do, I guess.
Well, I think a lot of that, too, is that, I mean, look at these women and their significant others were not quite as famous as they were. So I think it's just a huge blow to the male ego that they can't cope with.
That's insane. That would be ridiculous, but I guess you're right.
I think I'm totally right. Moving on.
Our next story is about The Final Destination, which apparently is not The Final Destination. And just after Clash of the Titans, Alan Meyer was there introducing all of these films that Warner Brothers is going to release. And he talked about how the success of The Final Destination will spur yet another sequel, I guess. The final destination. I don't know what they'll call it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
Big whoop.
Michael?
It's very much a big whoop.
Okay.
Maybe it'll be in 4D.
Maybe it'll be in 5D.
Then moving on to Christian Slater, who is shooting for a third television series, a comedy about a renegade Titan team that cracks security systems. And it follows his My Own Worst Enemy and The Forgotten, which apparently has been forgotten. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. If at first you don't succeed, try again. It's good to know Christian has gumption.
It's a big whoop. He's clearly a show killer.
Our next story is about Rosie O'Donnell, who is plotting a return to daytime television. She's gone into business with Scott Carlin, the former head of HBO Domestic Distribution, and Dick Robertson, the ex-head of Warner Syndication. The show will be hosted by Rosie O'Donnell. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, this is a huge deal because I don't think it's a coincidence that Rosie decides to do this the same year that Oprah announces her departure.
Michael?
I'm tempted to say it's a big whoop because they talk about it being more political than her old show, and I think she belongs more on a cable news network show like MSNBC if that's what she wants to do more in prime time. But she's very popular, so if she is gearing a show towards daytime with that right tone and tenor, then it could be a big deal.
With that, we'll move over to Inside Baseball. And you're right, Karen, the Viacom YouTube thing could have been our Inside Baseball topic this week. However, decided to go with Spotify and the delay to reach the U.S. market. Spotify has more than 7 million users and in six European countries, Britain, France, Spain, Sweden, Finland, and Norway. And it's basically a music service. The vast majority of its users use the free ad-supported version of the streaming music service, and about 320,000 or less than 5% pay a monthly fee of about 10 euros, which is roughly $13.50 to subscribe to a premium service which streams a higher quality audio and lets users download and play songs
explain what it is. Spotify is sort of like Pandora and some other online services where you can stream music. It's free. It has a database of like 10 million songs. And basically you can go on there and you can just pick from almost any music that's out there and start to play an album or a song or whatever. And every three or four songs, you'll get a quick ad inserted into the middle of it, like a quick 10-second little bleep that will, you know, be an ad, and then you continue back with the music. And so it's sort of like it's as if you had an iPod with access to like every song ever written. You know, there's so much music available in there and a lot of the current stuff. This is the difference between them and a lot of others. They have all the new albums that are out. If a new album is out, chances are it's on Spotify and you can stream it and start listening to it right away. So it's like on-demand radio, or like going to MySpace and choosing what you want to play. But you can do it on a computer. You can do it on your phone. It's really quick and easy to use. Everybody gets it. And it's sort of finally cracked the nut of the subscription idea where instead of buying music, you just pay for the right to listen to a huge database of music. And they have enough major labels on it that it's actually taken off and working in Europe.
Now, that's the key. It's in Europe. And Daniel Ek, who is 26 years old, is the founder and CEO of the company. And he said that he wanted to bring Spotify to the U.S. However, in the U.S., which is probably, if not the world's largest music market, definitely ranks up there. Well, the U.S. music market is a little different. They're not so happy to see it coming to the U.S. And Daniel Ek spoke at a South by Southwest panel, which occurred last week in Austin, Texas. He said that talks with record labels, along with thousands of music publishers and royalty collectors, had been bogged down over all the details that will be required to allow this service to come to the United States, and excited the complexity of dealing with numerous rights holders for the delay. And here's his quote. He says, "This is a very, very complex industry. It's an industry that's been in decline for 10 years. They just want to make the right bet. We've always said we wanted to launch in early 2010. We still hope that will be the case. That said, I don't think it matters for us if it's 2 or 3 months later. The U.S. is the world's biggest market." Well, so that answers that question. "And to use an American phrase, we really want to hit it out of the park," which should tell you that he's not American, and he probably should have said, "We really want to hit a home run," but that's another story.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing, yeah. I think that, you know, look, I've tried to start an MP3 music blog, as you know, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my problem is that for every single track that I put up, and I was only going to put one up a day, usually even from an unknown artist, there's like 3, 4, 5 different groups of people that you have to talk to. The publisher, the PR person, the musician's management, their age. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Of course, the label. And so it's really become, I mean, this is such an old model that is really bogging down business. And I think it's got to be shattered at some point.
But haven't they figured that out in Europe? I mean, they have publishers and agents and music publishers and royalty collectors and all those same interests in Europe. So clearly they solved the problem in Europe. Why doesn't the same – I'm not quite sure why the same approach that worked there can't work here.
Neither am I.
They figured it out, obviously.
Neither am I. My Edgar Bronfman Jr., who is the head chief executive of the Warner Music Group, said, "Free streaming services are clearly not a net positive for the industry. So this sort of get all the music you want for free and then maybe we can move you to a premium price strategy is not the kind of approach to business that we will be supporting in the future." So he's out, and he's always said that.
Right. It's just to them, it's like, why let people listen to the music for free? What possible advantage is there?
Right. And I look at what happened with Merton and Ben Folds in less than a week about how that kind of...
Yeah, but nobody made any money on it.
True.
Oops.
That's not true, actually. YouTube made money on it.
Are there ads in it?
None of the guys who created the music made money on it. They did it for free. They posted it for free on YouTube, and YouTube made money.
Well, I'll say this. YouTube does share some of the ad revenue with the people who posted the videos. So
but you have to be part of their ad rev share program.
Yeah, this guy's probably not a part of that.
Although, actually, that's true and not true. Yes, you have to be a part of it. However, if you have enough views, like this, the 4 million views that Merton has, then they will make you a part of that network. It's just kind of a default thing.
Retroactively?
I think they started at some point. A friend of mine actually had some video go viral, and they just kind of contacted him.
Yeah, I think you're right. Once they hit a certain number of views, I think they do start sharing it. I don't think it's retroactive. I think you have to hit a number of views, and then it goes on from there.
Yeah, moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I also agree with, frankly, Edgar Bronfman. I don't see how you can make enough money off of the streaming service, this free streaming service, to make it reasonable. Why put your music on there?
What is radio? It's a free streaming service with ads. So what's
the
difference?
It's not free. The artists get paid every time. Everybody gets paid every time stuff gets played on there.
Right. I believe.
And they have control. They don't put the whole album out. In fact, they legally aren't allowed to play as a matter of course, do not. You can't stream more than like 3 songs from an album within an hour. You can't, you typically don't play the whole album. Radio stations don't do it. They play a song to get you interested in buying the song and the album. And they have a pattern and a thing. This is like the album comes out and they start playing the whole thing, and you can at any time start playing the whole album. It's very different from radio. Why would you ever buy it if you can play it for free whenever you want?
Well, that's the difference between the own generation, you know, where you have to own everything, and this generation, whatever the generation is now, Y, Z, I don't know where we are, but where they don't feel that they have to own anything. They can just rent it for a little while, and it's all kind of intangible to them.
Well, they believe everybody should share, and that includes, you know, big business.
Yeah, they don't feel like they have to pay for anything. Oh, people should just create music, and I should be able to listen to it whenever I want. I feel obliged to go out and buy an album. I've gotten albums for free from some sources, not illegally, but then I go out intentionally and purchase the whole album because I want to make sure they get their money and that they benefit from all that because I want to support the artist.
So you get a record from the label?
Yeah, I'll get like an advance and I'll go out and purposely buy the final product for artists that I really like because I want them to benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I could very easily go and download the latest U2 or Bruce Springsteen or any of the artists that sure. I like, but I purposefully avoid doing that because I actually do want to go out and purchase their album. And I thought, frankly, Pearl Jam did a very smart thing, although they started as grunge rockers and now have an exclusive deal with Target and appear in their commercials. That's another story entirely. But, you know, I actually had to go to Target to buy this album. I couldn't buy it at any other record store or at used somewhere or on Amazon. I had to go to...
Was Backspacer only at Target, or do you mean their greatest hit, that greatest hits compilation?
No, Backspacer, their last album.
Oh, that's one of the best albums in years.
I know.
Oh, I didn't know it was only at Target. Oh, that's a shame. Maybe I bought it there. I did buy it there. I did buy it. I must have bought it there. I had no idea.
Well, I think what we're saying is Spotify will ultimately come to the U.S. How it comes, we don't know. But that this is yet another sign that the world of music is changing and probably does have to change a little to keep up with technology.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I should tell you that if you want a link to that story on Spotify or any of the stories that we discussed on this episode, you can visit our website, showbizsandbox.com is the address. That is also where you can find links to all of our social networking sites from YouTube to LinkedIn, Facebook, of course, Twitter. If you want to email us, you can do so. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Please feel free to send us comments, corrections, love letters, anything you want. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our shows is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward can be found online. Her website is karenwoodwardonline.com. She is also on Twitter. The username to look up is @Karen_Woodward. Michael Giltz is on Twitter. His username is a little easier. It's @MichaelGiltz. And his website is even easier than that. It's just michaelgiltz.com. That's where you can find all of his writing. I can be found. I always say that. I can be found as if somehow I live at Celluloid Junkie. But some of my writing can be found at Celluloid Junkie.
Tron.
Celluloidjunkie.com is the website to look up. I'm also on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.
Sad to say, it's time to go, but go to iTunes and rank our show.
We're going to have to change your name to Merton.
That's awesome.